This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The election of the nation's first African-American president sent a message to many that America's problems with race relations had been relegated to the dustbin of history. Not so fast. Although Barack Obama's election certainly signaled a new era in this country's troubled and troubling history of race relations, our problems in that area aren't completely over, and many, including the president, would like to use his election as a means to start a new dialogue on the topic that might help to finally put the past behind us. But that conversation, an open and honest one, must happen first. Coincidentally, well before before it became apparent that Barack Obama would become President Obama, forces in Charlotte had already decided to continue that conversation. Libraries in the region, including the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Library, had already decided to team up with the National Endowment for the Arts to engage people in discussing a single landmark novel, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. Those discussions have been taking place around the region for months, and we'll spend time talking about the novel, the picture it paints of race relations in the South in the 1930s, and what modern readers can learn from it later in the program. But another institution in Charlotte also took it upon themselves to further the conversation about race relations, and they also made that decision long before Senator Obama became a shoo-in for the presidency. The Children's Theater of Charlotte commissioned author-playwright Bob Inman to write a play geared toward middle and high school audiences, exploring how race plays a role in relationships. That play, The Drama Club, recently had its world premiere at the theater and is in performance now at Imagina. The theater also has partnered in a series of free monthly events called Teens and Race, Then and Now. And joining us to talk about both the play and I suppose that series of conversations is the playwright of The Drama Club, my friend Bob Inman. Good to see you again.
Always good to be here, Mike.
You never change. You always look the same.
Well, I have a twin brother, see, okay. That I send out. He's got gray hair.
And the artistic director of the Children's Theater and the director of this particular production, The Drama Club, Alan Poindexter, is back with us again. Good to see you as well.
Good morning, Mike.
Now, the Children's Theater commissioned this play to be written by Bob Inman. I take it on this topic, correct?
We did. We actually considered doing a piece, a historical piece, on Brown versus Board of Education, or specifically on busing here in Charlotte. And then we asked Bob, because Bob has been such a wonderful collaborator and such a great person to work with at the theater, we asked him to be a part of this process, and he brought to the table the notion that this work has been done and explored over the years and explored very well through documentaries, other plays, books, and that's probably not what we... That's not where we could focus our attention. And he was absolutely right. I mean, the magic of what he brought to the table is that we are now having a dialogue about where students are today, where they stand today, and where history has brought us.
Do we need that dialogue today?
I think we do. I mean, I think there's so much that we haven't dealt with. We sort of had court cases that pushed us together, and we haven't had the conversation. I don't think we've had the conversation in a healthy way with each other. And certainly Bob says we need to address our differences. And to do that, to address our differences, would then be to find common ground. And I agree with that 100%.
I read the play. Give us the thumbnail of the plot, Bob.
It takes place in a high school drama club. I was looking for a small group that would represent a larger group, the whole high school. There's a rivalry between a black student and a white student for the lead in the fall play that the drama club is putting on. And the rivalry leads to a confrontation, which leads to it spreading throughout the entire school, taking sides, and even a riot in a hallway. It's how something small can blow up in a situation where people aren't talking to each other except on a very surface level.
And to me, when I read it, and I haven't seen it yet, but when I read it, it's not just about race relations. It's about the suspicions that arise between people when they don't really understand people's motives and misread or even think that there is an agenda where there is none.
You've hit the nail on the head. That's the best description of what we've done. I've heard, Alan.
Write that down.
Let's see. It'll get a recording of that. It is about more than race. We're all fearful of the unknown. And there are people around us all the time who are different from us. Mm-hmm. And it's about how we reconcile ourselves with our differences. If we don't, then there's always the potential for something blowing up because we don't have any real understanding below the surface.
What I liked about this when I read it is it's very theatrical. I mean, it lends itself to remarkably inventive staging, it would seem to me. And, of course, he uses lots of video mm-hmm. in this, which the Children's Theater has done before to great success. But people have no idea how complicated that makes a production like this.
Right. I mean, the production looks very simple when you sit down to watch it. I mean, there are folding chairs on the stage, mm-hmm. basically a big screen and a bare theater. But, you know, there are over 400 cues in the show with the video and the lights and sound. So it's an extremely complicated piece, but it was magic to work on something that was about the work that we do every day because it's about high school students doing theater.
You've been doing this since I think March the 13th is when it opened, and you do it every day for students, but there are two more opportunities for the public to see this that I want to mention, and that's on Saturday and Sunday of this week at 4 p.m. on Saturday and 2 p.m. on Sunday at the Children's Theater. When you perform this for students, what has been their reaction? Do you get a chance to talk to them after the show or in these talkbacks that the have been scheduled throughout all this?
We have had conversations with student groups. Bob has had an opportunity certainly to talk to a group that he worked with on this piece that I hope he'll be able to talk about in a second. It's been exciting. I mean, I think we had our best audience yesterday morning. We had several middle schools brought big groups of at-risk students to come to the play, and the energy in that auditorium and the sort of feedback between the actors and the audience, just that energy exchange that we understand if you perform, was phenomenal yesterday. And the response to the play was sort of unbelievable. The kids were on their feet before it was over.
Wow.
You know, I think it proves, and it's proven since it opened, that the dialogue is important to young people. And acknowledging them on a very straightforward level is important.
We have a lot of newcomers to this area who don't know that Bob Inman, for the longest time, anchored television news and was a highly rated news anchor in this area and started dabbling in his spare time in writing novels. And several of them became very successful novels, one of which was turned into a Hallmark Hall of Fame show, Home Fires Burning, which you also wrote the screenplay for. That led you into writing screenplays under your own name and doctoring things that other people had written over the years. And then, for some reason, you got interested in theater, where there is no money, Bob. But you got
spoken like a true thespian.
You got involved in theater, and you've been writing all these plays recently. And what fascinates me about, because I guess it's because I know you. If I didn't know you, I would think nothing about this. But you wrote this based around this group in this school called the Drama Club. Every high school has a drama club. And the Drama Club are a very tight-knit, very cliquey group that in amongst themselves, they are the in crowd. But inside the high school, they are the out crowd.
Mm-hmm. They are. That's right. That's
absolutely. Right.
How did you capture that? Because you captured it. I mean, you got the essence of it dead right.
Well, the kids are telling me who come to see the play, yeah, I got it. You know, I captured high school. I have to give a lot of credit to the drama club, the West Stanley Players at West Stanley High School over in Oakboro in Stanley County. I got to know them and their director, Wes Tucker, two or three years ago. They performed The Christmas Bus, one of my mm-hmm. plays, and they let me just come sit in. And I did that for months. I would drop in every once in a while on classes and rehearsals and auditions and productions, and really just I became sort of part of the furniture and absorbed what they were doing in there. And not just as a drama club, but as high school students. And I don't think I could have written the play, certainly not to connect as well as it seems to be connecting with the audience without Wes and his kids.
What happens in this play is that they're about to audition for one of the yearly dramas that they do at the school, and they prepare for this over the course of the year, and it's fairly certain our stars emerge in the drama club over the course of a year, and they think that they're going to take the lead, and most often they do in this play. Then this new girl comes in from out of town, auditions on her second day at the school, and gets the lead, and she's African-American, which starts the ball rolling in this. Now, there was a movie called Remember the Titans about my alma mater, T.C. Williams High School, and they used the football team as the thing for this. I mean, it's the same story, almost the same story. You chose drama. Why? Because kids can relate to football players, but the drama club is the out-group. Why choose the drama club as the setting for this?
Well, in a way, I guess, Mike, it's a play within a play.
It is.
It's a play about a drama club, but it's acted out within the drama club. There are two adult roles, the principal and the drama club director, teacher. But I liked the idea of getting inside this group that's very close-knit. They call themselves a theater family, and seeing how that could implode, explode, could come apart because of a conflict.
Well, and I think it's really important that you say they're the out group. That makes them tighter knit, ultimately. I mean, we know just from our personal experience how strong that group can be. And to see that group break apart on this issue makes it a more powerful discussion because they are a closely knit group. And they are, you know, they have nowhere else within that school. And for them to break their own sort of bonds over this issue means it's a powerful dialogue that we need to have.
And there is powerful dialogue within the play, and I'm certainly that it provokes thoughts and dialogue outside among the audience. What kind of conversations did you have among the cast during the course of rehearsing and producing this?
Well, I mean, we were still working on the play. As a matter of fact, we are still working on the play. It's very exciting to work with a collaborator like Bob. The dialogue has been about, you know, about everything, the issue, the structure of the play, how the story comes across to the audience. And I think that in one way or another, everyone within this process, a personal story has come to the surface about this issue. And something that we've all experienced in our past has played into our feelings about this piece, as I'm sure it does for the audience, and I hope it does for the audience. You can't discuss this issue without acknowledging your own place in the history of this.
There's a character in this play who I really like. The camera kid. Camera kid. He's the narrator. He reminds me of a cross between the narrator in Our Town and the guy in the wheelchair in Oz and the guy with the camera in Rent. Please tell me he's not wearing a scarf.
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
but he said he has the same speech at the opening of the play as he does at the end of the play, which I think is a clever device because it goes in different directions at the end.
I have to give total credit for that idea to Alan Poindexter, who is not only a brilliant director, he's a great story guy. Alan really gets the whole idea of telling a story on stage and letting the audience take from it what they will. And I had written a different ending, and Alan and I talked about it, and he said, let me throw out an idea. And his idea was just perfect. It brings the play full circle, but with a different outcome.
Right. Yeah. I have 20 seconds. What happens to the play next after it closes at the Children's Theater?
We're going to keep working on it.
We're rewriting.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
That is a neat part of this, that you get to do work on a brand new piece and shape it and mold it and make it something that's special. Alan Poindexter, Bob Inman, thank you for joining us. The play runs for the public 4 o'clock Saturday, 2 o'clock Sunday at the Children's Theater at Imagineon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Our pleasure.
Our program is made possible in part today by Ray Ward, Creative Marketing Communications, offering advertising, public relations, interactive media, and direct marketing services to businesses throughout the region on the web at rayward.com. Well, with daylight savings time, you have an extra hour in the afternoon to come home after a hard day at work and start a hard day in the garden. And maybe you're looking for some new ideas, new ways to spruce up your yard, some new trends that are happening that you want to be the first in your neighborhood to be part of. Well, tomorrow, in an encore presentation of this program, you will get a chance to hear from Roger Cook, the longtime head landscaper on the PBS show This Old House. He'll be here along with a couple of other guests to get you started, perhaps, in a new direction or help you do something that you've been doing wrong for the longest time right. tomorrow at 9 o'clock.
On the 6th anniversary of the Iraq invasion, a look at how the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are affecting the state of the U.S. military, its troop levels, funding, and the role of technology in how wars are fought. The Diane Rehm Show, Thursday.
As always, you're invited to join the conversation coming up from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on The Diane Rehm Show here on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The state of relations between the races in America was set a long time ago during our history of the slave days. Despite the Civil War, despite the Emancipation Proclamation, despite Reconstruction, or perhaps because of those three events, race relations were clouded by years of Jim Crow and other oppressions that left African Americans with a lot of catching up to do before they could achieve true equality. Modern Americans may not really understand what life was like before the Civil Rights Movement. Those in positions of privilege might not fully understand just how unjust our treatment of blacks has been. All you really have to do to gain a rudimentary understanding of this is to read a work of fiction that came out in the 1960s, written about a time in the Deep South of the 1930s. Harper Lee wrote only one novel in her life, but that one work turned out to be a blockbuster. To Kill a Mockingbird tells a devastating story of how unspoken rules perpetuated the oppression of one race by another, and how silence about injustice enforced by peer pressure and tradition can have tragic circumstances, both immediate and long-lasting. This year, To Kill a Mockingbird was the book chosen for an event called The Big Read. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Library and libraries throughout the region teamed up with the National Endowment for the Arts to have people all over the area read this novel. For some, it was their first exposure to the story of Atticus Finch, a small-town lawyer defending an African-American wrongly accused of rape. For others, it was a chance to revisit a story they either read in the past or viewed as the famous movie starring Gregory Peck. Most of those revisiting the story say this reading allowed them to see the characters, the setting, and the time in a new light. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of this show talking about. We're joined by Charles Brown, the Director of Libraries for the Public Library of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Arden McLaughlin is the Education Partnership Coordinator for the Public Library System in Mecklenburg County. She organized the Big Read events that have been taking place around the area, as well as the podcast version of To Kill a Mockingbird, read by local media members and other personalities other than myself, who was not asked. Hello.
Hello. How are you? Tim took your spot.
That's all right. How did you get the rights to do a podcast of this book?
I asked for them.
And they gave them
to you?
They
did.
That's astounding. And Linda Hagler is a teacher in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools and the teaching expert for the novel in the Big Read program. And I asked jokingly before we started here, how many of you have read the book?
Right.
and
oh,
you,
yes.
And you said, Linda, you've read it, slept with it, taught it.
Taught it, eaten with it. It is my book.
Well, we're going to talk about it. And if you'd like to join our conversation about it, because a lot of people have read this book, either as part of the Big Read or because they read it in high school or because they read it late in life. If you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE. You can email us, join us on our blog, on Facebook, or on Twitter at WFAE.org/Charlotte blog. So I'm glad to see you shaking your head in disbelief.
Just
Linda,
too much. I mean,
all right, first, about the Big Read. Where did this idea for the Big Read come from? How many times have we participated in it? And is it a local idea or is it a national
idea? It's a national idea, and I believe this is the first time we participated.
It is the first time.
It was initiated by the National Endowment for the Arts. They hosted a training program last summer in Minneapolis. And following that, libraries were given a list of approximately 20 to 25 titles that they could choose from to promote during the course of a, you know.
Why would they limit the titles? Why can't you choose your own title?
Or do you know why they
limited? I really think it's because they provide so much material for it. And also, really, the NEA started the Big Read about 5 years ago because they were starting to notice literacy was going down, mm-hmm. reading was going down and libraries were not being used. So the real focus behind the National Endowment of the Arts creating the Big Read was to get libraries back in. So they found these 20 to 25 classic books that they felt like were classics, mm-hmm. that they felt like people should be reading and could start dialogues.
And why did this library choose? And it wasn't just this library, this whole region. Are there other areas?
Inadvertently, yes. Iredell County and Mecklenburg County chose To Kill a Mockingbird.
Why To Kill a Mockingbird?
I would think one of the reasons was it really is appropriate specifically to the history of this region, mm-hmm. In terms of race relations. And I think that played a major role in terms of just trying to create a dialogue about mm-hmm. what things have been like, in the past.
And you said a minute ago that the National Endowment provided training.
Training and financial support.
Training for what?
Training to run the Big Read. It is insane. It's amazing how much work you have to do, when you get into getting your partners involved. And for a lot of our library system is does quite a good job at partnering with other organizations and getting folks involved. But a lot of libraries, especially when you think about smaller ones, don't know how to reach out to schools, don't know what all really needs to entail mm-hmm. to run a successful Big Read. So we went and got trained on what to do, the tools that they provide a lot of tools, teaching curriculums that our schools have used. So we got trained how to use those.
What constitutes success?
What constitutes success? I've been asked that so many times. And honestly, success for me was going to be if I had random people coming up to me on the street, or I had my friends telling me, I saw someone reading To Kill a Mockingbird today, and I really did. I'd start getting notes on Facebook. Hey, you'd never believe it. I saw this guy at a restaurant sitting in his business suit reading To Kill a Mockingbird, and the newspapers picked up, the radio, everyone picked up on it and knew what the Big Read was. We were at the Bobcats game and people came up to my table and were like, oh, you're the Big Read lady, and started taking the books and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I do have to, I really have to say that, and I've shared this with Arden, this program has exceeded my every expectation. There have been other communities around the country that have had Big Read type programs, but I have never seen a community embrace a book the way that Charlotte Mecklenburg has embraced this book.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
The school system, and, Linda can talk more about that. Mecklenburg County government, the Charlotte Observer has just done an incredible job. I mean, even down to the recipes in the book. And most recently, they identified, a sole survivor of the man who wrote the book that's mentioned at the very end of the book, that, mm-hmm. The Trout, troop is reading.
Yeah.
Scout is reading.
Right.
Yeah. Scout troop.
So Linda Hagler, you're with the school system.
Yes.
The schools read this book anyway at some point, don't they have the
not
kids?
Always,
really?
Not always. It depends on funding. And of course they have a huge list that they can choose from. But, so often more contemporary works kind of push it aside, which is a real shame. Mm-hmm. But when the title came up, then the old love flame just flamed up there. Teachers pulled it out. Not every school had copies of the book. There were plenty of excess.
Even in
their
library?
Well, no, they had it in their library and all, but we're talking about class sets of the book. And so they used the movie as well as the book. And it was amazing. And you asked her just a moment ago, what was success? I can give you the most wonderful story. South Mecklenburg had an exhibition. They displayed in their lobby big displays of student work. They had a Southern meal. Then they had about 300 people from the community, the parents and the students, just come in to discuss the book. But my favorite part was when I walked in, there were students dressed like characters from the book. And a little guy with a white shirt and white shorts and knee socks came walking up to me and said, hi, my name is Dill, and I'm in the fourth grade, and I can read, although I am small for my age. That student conquered. That is success. When you can get high school students who are so busy text messaging and into that to look at the book and say, now that character, I like that character.
Well, this book takes place in the 1930s mm-hmm. in Alabama.
Yeah.
And it's told through the eyes and ears and mouthpiece of a little girl. Mm-hmm. So how do students today react to a story that took place for them so long ago, so long before any of them were born? It was written before any of them were born.
Yeah. But they had no trouble with it because the ideas, the topics, the issues have not changed. We still deal with racism. We still deal with the class system. They still struggle with influences on their family, their school, their community that shapes that community and shapes that family and school. These are all things that students deal with. So although we talk about 1930, if you close your eyes, except for just certain scenes of it, it is 2009 all over again.
Give me an example of that.
Well, it would be things like, how do we deal with people in our society that are just very different, like Boo? Mm-hmm. Don't we tend to just kind of turn away? Like when we see the homeless man on the corner begging for money, it's so easy just to turn away instead of dealing with him. Or how do we deal with people who let their ignorance just become so prominent? Do we take a stand against it, mm-hmm. or do we again just back away? So in this little precocious girl named Scout, and it's her innocence that becomes such a star in this novel, we want to be more like Scout, who looks at the face of a mob and says, how's your family? Mm-hmm. I bring Walter home to eat lunch with me sometimes.
Yeah, she diffuses the mob by bringing it home.
She does, because she doesn't see it as a mob.
Yeah.
She sees it as individuals that she knows. And so students, as they begin to look at the book, they know that there's racism. Mm-hmm. But then they may be sitting beside someone of another race who is their friend.
I'm maybe you don't know the answer to this question, but I'm curious about the reaction to this book when it came out, because of the fact that it tells the story of this racist society that doesn't even think of itself as being racist, doesn't know it's racist. It just, this is the way it is, it's the way it's always been. There are these unwritten rules about how we deal with people black and white and people within the white race of different social strata. We deal with them in certain ways, and that's just the way it is. Don't question it, that's just the way it is. The kids in this book see the injustice in this, are angered by the injustice in this, and anybody seeing it through their eyes has to also see it. Mm-hmm. So how was this book received in the 1960s? This was pre-civil rights. This is pre the March on Washington. Was she considered, Harper Lee considered a rabble-rouser? Was this acceptable in the South? How controversial was this?
I don't know about.
I would say it was
controversial.
Look at the fact that she never wrote another book again. It was amazingly controversial. And the fact that she became so popular, the book became such a bestseller. It's been a classic ever since. Truman Capote, her best friend, totally wrote her off after her success.
Because she eclipsed him, didn't she?
Well, there's so many rumors about it, but basically what I have read is he was completely jealous of her success that he never reached.
Right.
So she just pretty much, people say that Truman wrote it and all these sorts of things, but she disappeared. It wasn't what, she was had a story to tell, and a true artist has a story to tell, and she walked away from it. It's always been a very successful mm-hmm. book. I just think it's fascinating that it's still successful today. When I look at my generation, we never saw busing. We never saw, and I'm in the more in the Gen Y generation, just for your listeners, but I'm pretty young. But we never saw it. So for me to read this book again, but I see the classism that we have today. I see the single father raising. So there's these issues that these kids, it's still relevant today, but it just continues to morph. It's one of those books that more.
And I guess to answer your question, Mike, I'm a little bit older than Art,
mm-hmm.
and I have a first person experience with it because I was a high school student in the late 60s mm-hmm. in a border state in St. Louis, Missouri, in a racial high school. And I don't recall the book itself really being that controversial. I mean, we read it as a good story. Now, maybe we're all being very politically correct in the early days of school integration.
I conducted a discussion about this book with Diane English and Tom Hanchett and Willie Ratchford for the county. And Willie Ratchford talked about his experience in reading this book as a black high school student and how when he read it, and he's probably a little younger than you, but he's well into adulthood. When he read it as a high school student, he said it really, really, really made him angry. He said, I was sitting there with my afro and reading this book and just got, you know what, PO'd. Mm-hmm. And he said, it was interesting to pick it up as an adult and read it and have a completely different experience with it.
And I think that's where so many adults came up to me and like, oh, I read it in high school. I'm like, no, read it again, because I had a completely different experience with it. Because it did. I didn't understand it. It made me angry. But reading it now, I'm like, wow. Yeah, you do.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because you deal with high school. You're young, and you deal with high school students.
I do.
This would be foreign territory for them in most situations. And I'm curious, did they look at this as a work of fiction that was simply a novel that some lady made up out of whole cloth? Or do they see this as something that really points to our historically accurate past? How do they see it?
You know, it's hard for high school students, it's hard for young people to capture the past, the feel, the passions of the past. They're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
And wonderfully enough, right now, they don't see the class system that the people of the 30s saw. And they look back and they say, oh, that's a long time ago. That's in that South area. You know, it doesn't really touch them. They're not aware that sometimes they still deal with racial prejudice. And now the election that was sparked a lot of passion about that as well. And so it was very appropriate that we did this novel this year with this particular election.
Did the election or the candidacy of Barack Obama play a role in choosing this novel?
Not at all. When I applied for this grant, people asked me that. Hillary was winning the nomination, mm-hmm. and the economy was wonderful mm-hmm. when I applied for it. So neither one of those went into it. I just wanted a slam dunk book when I chose this one.
You know, when Harper Lee wrote this, she said that she was asked many times why she only wrote one book. And she said, I only had one story to tell. Mm-hmm. And when you look at this novel, you see in it all stories.
Yeah.
You see conflicts between the family. You're looking at a single parent raising children. That's something that we deal with today.
Mm-hmm.
You also see right versus wrong. And where do you take your stand? You see the treatment of those that are the less fortunate, those that are poverty people. And so,
and you see rationalizations.
Oh, absolutely.
And you see adults who are on the right side sometimes making bad decisions or the wrong decision because it's either politically expedient to do so or because you can't win every battle, so you pick the battles that mm-hmm. you fight, which is particularly difficult for children and for Atticus Finch's children to deal with, because
yes.
Atticus is a good man in a tough situation and has to make some decisions that he doesn't like, but he knows that he can't win everything.
Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like this book needs a subtitle called To Kill the Mad Dog, because I think that scene is so powerful.
Yes.
Because that's anything that endangers our society.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I noticed in the movie and when kids read it, they don't sympathize with the dog, which is very rare when you have an animal in a story. They see that dog as being something far greater than just an animal. They see it as being whatever it would be in a society that would destroy or harm that society. Mm. And then when Atticus is the only one to stand up to put an end to it, as he did in the trial, you see these little innocent children getting a wonderful lesson in, I don't only see it and speak against it, I take a stand against it.
That's Linda Hegler, who's the high school literacy coordinator for Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. We're talking about The Big Read with her and Charles Brown from the library and Arden McLaughlin from the library and, of course, the book To Kill a Mockingbird. We'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by the Charlotte Housing Authority, providing safe and affordable housing for families in need, and the Moving Forward program, which helps them become self-reliant. With housing, there's a way. Details at cha-nc.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Susan Page is in for Diane, and on the 6th anniversary of the Iraq invasion, they'll take a look at how the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are affecting the state of the U.S. military, its troop levels, funding, and the role of technology and how wars are fought, with the Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times, Tom Shanker, the Vice President of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, Robert Work, and several others. If you'd like to join our conversation about To Kill a Mockingbird or your experience in The Big Read, if you in fact read it as a part of The Big Read, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or by email or blog.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life here on WFAE. And let's face facts, you hate the pledge drive, we hate the pledge drive. And WFAE is taking action this pledge drive to make the misery shorter. Basically, before the drive ever starts, we're asking you to go to WFAE.org and pledge before we're begging on the air. And the idea is that'll mean fewer days on the air asking for money, fewer interruptions in programming. Help us in this mission at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, which was the book to be read this year by The Big Read in Mecklenburg and Irondale and...
County. In North Carolina, anyway.
All right. With Arden McLaughlin, who is the Education Partnership Coordinator. She's the person who actually made all this happen at the public library and beyond. Charles Brown is the Director of Libraries for the library. And Linda Hagler is a high school literacy coordinator with Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools who helped teach this and promote this and all kinds of things. British librarians. Rank this novel as one that every adult should read before they die, ahead of the Bible. Do you agree with that?
I'm not going to say that.
I mean, for British people to say that, that's just kind of interesting. The famous movie, mm-hmm. has been alluded to in this conversation several times. And people today probably would rather see the movie than read the book, although you lose so much whenever you watch a movie that used to be a book, because they can't put everything in the book in the movie. But if you saw this movie and only saw this movie, would you get the story as deeply, as intently?
No. The movie, I went back and watched the movie because we did some movie viewings and had some experience with it. But the movie is solely, to me, it's solely about the trial. And when I went back and read the book, I didn't realize what a small part of the book the trial actually
yes,
is.
Yes, I was waiting for the trial and waiting for the trial.
Oh, yeah. And then the trial ends and there's still many more chapters of the book left to go. I think the movie is fantastic. And it grasps a lot of the father-daughter and the race relations, but you don't get the classism. You don't get the learning to be a good parent. I was thinking about what you're talking about. Parents should read it. Parents today, learn to be a good parent and that you are setting an example for your children. And, you know, even if your children are thoroughly embarrassed by your actions, which I always was by my parents. But, you know, there are things like that the movie doesn't grasp. But I think the movie's a great teaser to get into the book.
You know, Atticus Finch, aside from being a great lawyer, is a very wise father.
Mm-hmm.
Do people really exist like that? Because he's very wise.
Scarily, my dad was Atticus Finch. Yes. You know, he didn't say a lot, but he sat and read with me all the time, and he really was that wise man but he would have played football for the Methodist. He, unlike Atticus Finch, who did nothing, he would not play with the Methodist.
Now, the racism is not as overt as it is in this book, and the injustice today, hopefully, is not as clear-cut as it is in this book, although I'm sure there are instances in it. I think I read a contemporary instance of it just the other day in the newspaper. But what is, I think, still happening today is social class. Okay. I mean, there's a long discussion in this book among the Finch children and Atticus Finch and also the Atticus's sister, whose name escapes me at the moment. But there's a discussion about how the Finches are above the Cunninghams, who are above the Yules, and why that's so. Mm-hmm. But we should still treat everybody with respect. At least that lesson was being taught in the Finch household.
Right.
But that is still so, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, our little folks in the school system could not read To Kill a Mockingbird. It just was not appropriate for our little ones. So
why?
They read...
little ones being what age?
Our little pre-K up
oh,
to...
Elementary
school children, yeah. And so they read...
But wait a minute. I'll let you say that. But it's told through the eyes of a first grader.
But it talks about some things that first graders should not know.
Well, Not okay. just that, right. but, you know, when you're that young, you still have a great deal of innocence.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't see the injustice because of their precious innocence.
They wouldn't understand it. Okay.
Yeah.
No.
But they did. They were given Sneetchers by Dr. Seuss, where you have these odd-looking birds that that make up their culture. But some birds have a star on their stomach, and some don't. And if you have a star, then you're part of the privileged group. Now, you're the same except for the star. Now, those little kids could easily begin to think of things like tennis shoes, as something as minor as tennis shoes. To even little small kids, they are very conscious of what a person's tennis shoes look like. And they began to talk about conversations came up with, well, you know, if you have a certain tennis shoe, that makes you better than somebody that has another kind of tennis shoe.
And the reason we did that, we had a little read that went along with the big read because we really, as a public library system, we want families reading together and able to discuss these topics together. So we had the elementary school students read the Sneetches, and then middle school kind of read the Maniac McGee, choosing for high school and above to read To Kill a Mockingbird, and had these discussions together about classism, about what makes us different.
Exactly.
But yet embracing the difference and working together as part of that.
So when you read this book, do you walk away with it saying, oh my, how far we've come since the 1930s? Or do you walk away saying, oh my, we have a lot of work to do here?
I think we still have a lot of work to do, but I know I read it again recently, well, within the past 3 years. One of the things I do also, I probably shouldn't say this on the air, is I lead book discussion groups and people invite me to do that. And one of the topics that we discussed was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I really did think how far we had come, because one of the subtle stories here is the role of blacks in this book. I mean, these are people in the 1930s who really viewed themselves as being second-class American citizens. You know, standing, I mean, they would never think of interacting with white people on any kind of even near equal level. And I think that really is a testament that we've come, you know, so far beyond that point in time. But people were really scarred, you know, by the experience.
And in this novel, the children of Atticus Finch, Scout and Jim, struggle to understand what defines and creates social inequity. Scout tends to believe that folks are just folks, while Jim is convinced that social standing is related to how long people's relatives and ancestors have been able to write. What kind of observations about this have come out of discussions with either young people or older people who are part of these discussion groups that have been going on for weeks here?
You know what? What was very interesting, we had movie night a couple weeks ago as part of a Front Porch Grant night, and we had an experiment where people came in based solely when they came in. They were handed different places to sit in the Maginot theaters, and some were treated quite privileged. Some were told, go sit up there, you can't sit down, like pretty much treated poorly. What was very interesting, a conversation came out of that. One of the women who was in the A group said, you know, I just felt so bad. I came with my friend and she had to go sit in the C group. And someone turned around and I felt bad she couldn't sit with me. And someone turned around and was like, well, you could sit wherever you wanted to. Why didn't you go back to the C group? She never thought about it. We as privileged, those of us in the privileged, don't think about going back, going to another group and reaching out. So it really, there's conversations that have sparked about reaching out to other people or walking in other people's shoes. That theme continues to come out. Atticus said it over and over. Take time to think about what that other person is going through, the injustice or
because
whatever.
Because Atticus was able to defend this black man wrongfully accused of rape.
And take the heat
for it in town, and right down the street, two doors down, is this woman who's a member of the Daughters of the American, not American Revolution, but she's obviously she's very prejudiced.
Yes.
And tells him to his face and tells his children what a bad man he is for taking this case, and yet he is friendly to her and treats her goldenly. I mean, it's pretty interesting. There's also a character in this novel named Mr. Raymond, who walks down the street with a beverage bottle in a bag.
The white man.
Yeah. And everybody assumes that he's a drunkard. But that bag contains a bottle of Coca-Cola. And only the kids know this. And he does this because he is living with, I'm not sure he's married to her, but he's living as a white man. He's living with an African-American woman, and they have children. And this is the way he diffuses people's comments about that situation. They just talk about how he's a drunk as opposed to that he, and that's why he
yes.
stoop so low as to be involved with this African-American woman. How do kids look at that today? Because we're well beyond interracial relationships now and problems with that. How do they look at this today?
Again, it's just so accepted in their world that it's only those of us on the outside who would comment to them that it is something that has not been accepted.
So why look back? Why drag this all up, these nasty things about our past?
No, it's the age-old thing. If you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. And I absolutely believe that's true.
And I think individuals, too, want to make themselves seem important. And sometimes to do that, they have to point at those that are not quite as important mm-hmm. as they are. And by putting someone else down, in their mind at least, they've brought themselves up, mm-hmm. which is such a falsehood.
Mm-hmm. Baldwin in Charlotte sent us an email, and he says, I downloaded Mockingbird into my iPod and listened while I walked every morning. I usually walk 50 minutes. Sometimes I walked far longer in order to hear the rest of the chapter. Why, they had an NPR driveway moment. I had resolved to only listen to it while I walked. Double incentive. I just wondered, does the library know the count of how many people downloaded the podcast?
We don't yet. I am going to get the counts, but I was going to wait until it was over before I go harassing my IT people to get that number.
Now, there's some there was some controversy. At least I perceived it to be controversy.
I was like, 7 minutes left. We don't have to talk about it.
Oh, yes, we do. Because this really ticked me off,
yeah,
to be honest with you,
does.
With regard to the controversy. And these are two of my friends who will go unnamed on this program. But they were asked, among the celebrities, they were asked to read a chapter in this book. And their chapters contained the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
One of these people is black, the other is white, mm-hmm. and they both said, no, I'm mm-hmm. not going to read that word. What was the outcome of that? Did you assign them different chapters?
We assigned them different chapters.
Okay, so the N-word was not eliminated.
No. As a librarian, as a lover of books, as a attempted writer myself, to alter a author's work and to take out that word, as I was berated by someone else, is to diminish the book. And I just, you can't.
It's the whole point of the book.
Exactly.
It's the whole point of the book.
Yeah.
But it is still the N-word.
Right.
So talk to me. You're the only African-American on the panel.
Yeah,
talk to me about
Karina.
The use of that word in this work of fiction that talks about a time in the past where that word was in common usage, not only among white people, but among black people. How should we view that word? Should we feel guilty about reading that word? Should we feel guilty if we are a performer being asked to record the iPod? Should we feel guilty about that? Would people cast aspersions on us for having read that word, said that word?
Yeah, it's a painful word, but unfortunately it's an important part of our history, and I think we need to keep that alive. Mm-hmm. And so I'm often, we haven't had that big a problem in the public libraries, but in school libraries across the country frequently, parents want to have, you know, books such as Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, not read in class. And interestingly, these are widely considered to be two of the most important works in American fiction. And so I think it's important that the words stay in and people just be reminded. But it is painful.
Any pushback from readers?
None at all. None of our readers. It has not come to my attention Mm-mm. that there have been any problems. Now.
Not since the podcast have I had any.
What view does the school system take on this?
Pretty much the same. We don't, you know, you don't want to diminish the idea that this is a unacceptable, ugly word. And to put it within its time period,
and this book makes that point.
Exactly. Yeah, I was going to say, Atticus makes that clear.
Absolutely. And so when students now come across and they're reading it, they stop. You've got a wonderful teaching moment because they don't want to say it. They want to read the work, and it's not a pleasant word to come out of their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so this teaching moment gets us into the idea of, you know, our society changes, our views have changed, and that includes some of our words.
Right.
And some of the words that we use today mm-hmm. to another generation will be looked on as unacceptable as well.
And I wish it would be unacceptable everywhere, because there are quite a few places where it's used quite frequently, and kids will say it like it's nothing. And, you know, it's a terrible word, but it's, It was part of the story. Right. And believe me, I took more heat and more flack and worried about it more.
Do people have difficulty understanding that it propels the story, it makes the story's point, and the very fact that students in a classroom would get to that word if they're reading it aloud and stop because they don't want to say it, doesn't mm-hmm. that make, do people have difficulty understanding that that makes the point? That is the point of the book.
But they won't, I think a lot of people want someone else to make the point.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Heather in Charlotte writes, Mike, please tell your listeners that if they love To Kill a Mockingbird, they must read Keepers of the House by Shirley Ann Graug, G-R-A-U, written in the 1960s, a Pulitzer Prize winner. It switches points of view between whites and blacks and has a killer ending. It will knock your socks off. So we have a listener who is passing along some information.
I hope we have it in the library's collection. I'll check it when I get back.
There's a masterfully, I only have a minute left, but there's a masterfully written scene at the end where Boo Radley finally makes an appearance after this whole novel of talking about, hearing about, mm-hmm. speculating about him. And it's in the bedroom, and they're trying to pin the murder of Mr. Yule on the little boy, Atticus is convinced that Jem did it, but the sheriff keeps saying no, and we're not going to say anything about it because it wasn't Jem that did it. It mm-hmm. would ruin Boo Radley's life. People mm-hmm. would cling to him, mm-hmm. and you have to read it a couple of times to figure out what was really going on there. Mm-hmm. To me, that makes it masterfully written because it was intricate.
Yeah, the detail.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book, and I had never read this book. Somehow it didn't come up in my life until the big read. So
English teacher?
Well, we spent that year doing diagramming sentences because
grammar.
No, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, and I presume to the rest of the class, because we read the first book in English literature and wrote our reports, and she said, "You can't write." So we're going to learn how to write this year. And that was back before you had to do what they told you to do at the state level. Linda Hagler, Arden McLaughlin, Charles Brown, thank you for joining us. The big read continues, right? It's still going on a little bit?
Closing events are Monday, March 23rd at Queen's University.
Okay, but just because it's closing doesn't mean you can't
read
the book.
Not at all.
And the library has ample copies.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.